Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. For a lot of Americans, familiarity with Kazakhstan begins and ends with Sacha Baron Cohen's Borat character, who poked mischievous fun at both America and Kazakhstan. Though the humor was primarily at America's expense, the ruse was achieved by sensationalizing and in some cases outright fictionalizing Kazakh traditions. Today we're going to learn more about the changing Kazakh reality, right now in 2014, with Allard Youngman. He's the chair of the linguistics department at KU, and he has an interesting relationship with the country and its language. Hi, Dr. Youngman.
Good morning.
So please remind our listeners where Kazakhstan is, in case it's been a little while since they last consulted a map of Central Asia.
It is in Central Asia, as you say. If you think about the former Soviet Union, that huge part there, east of Turkey and Poland and so on, and then it's kind of an appendage at the southern tip. There's a couple of Central Asian countries, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and so on.
So what are some of the key elements of Kazakh history, culture, and geography that someone should know before hearing about your project? Just very briefly to set things up. I realize that you're a linguist and not a historian.
Right, and I found out things as I went along. But, of course, there's a long tribal tradition of nomadic cultures on the plains there, both in Kazakhstan, Mongolia, and other republics like that. Then there was, of course, a period of Soviet domination. And now, since 1991, Kazakhstan is its own independent country.
What exactly is it that you are doing with the Kazakh language?
I'm consulting with researchers in Kazakhstan, and I'm helping them convert their Cyrillic-based alphabet and writing system to a Latin-based script, the way English, for example, many other languages are written.
For what reason?
Well, the main reason, this comes from high up, from the president of the country, who's kind of a Western-looking person. He thinks that the Cyrillic script is hampering economic development and other opportunities for the country, that if the language were written in a Latin-based script, that would be much more advantageous.
Why would a Latin script, according to him anyway, be more advantageous for Kazakhstan?
I think there's two reasons. One is that it would be easier for others to read. Now, of course, reading, being able to read the script doesn't necessarily mean that you understand the language. Probably an error we've all made at some point.
A good first step, though.
And also, I think he realizes the importance of English as the world language, as the lingua franca. So that also gets it more closely related to English.
Do you know the Kazakh language?
I don't. It's a Turkic language. I don't know any Turkish or any Turkic languages. I do know a little bit of Russian. I was an undergraduate major in Russian many years ago. And so the language currently is bilingual Kazakh and Russian. So that at least helped me a little bit.
That is so funny. In that case, how did you get involved with this project?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was contacted about 10 months ago by a graduate student working on this project. And he wrote to me rather than the professor because he knew English and the professor doesn't know any English. And he kind of explained the situation. He said, look, we're trying to convert our writing system, but step one is trying to figure out what the consonants and vowels of the language are. We actually don't know exactly what the consonants and vowels of Kazakh are.
What does that mean? Could you explain what it means to not know what the vowels of a language are?
Yeah, so in this particular case, I think it was due to two reasons, both having to do with Soviet domination. So one is that over the years, there had been many borrowings, loan words imported from Russian. That by now, if you do that for several generations, current Kazakh speakers think that are just Kazakh words. And so some of these borrowings have sounds in them that occur in Russian, but actually not in the native Kazakh vocabulary. So very common sounds like E and U occur in Russian, but not in Kazakh.
So if the language that people actually speak in Kazakh has so many Russian influences that have been sort of blended into it, and the language that you are translating into Latin script is sort of without those Russian influences, is that an accurate mirror of Kazakh today?
I would say it's not an accurate mirror of Kazakh today. It may be an accurate mirror of both Kazakh yesterday and tomorrow, because I think there will be this push to return to more of a original native vocabulary.
Why is that?
I think that's a sense of pride and a sense of trying to reject that domination, which is, of course, not a very nice period in history for the Kazakh people.
Well, are there advantages in terms of your own work to not being a Kazakh speaker and in taking on this project, or is that something that has been a source of struggle for you?
That's interesting. It's sort of a mixed blessing to be a native speaker of a language when you're working on that language. Sometimes you incorporate certain biases and you don't think or listen to your own language objectively. So I think in my case, since I simply had to work on what are the consonants, what are the vowels of the language, not being familiar with the language was actually helpful. Now, if I had to go on to more grammatical constructions and the syntax and the morphology, it may not have been helpful. But in this case, I think it was. You know, if you go up to a speaker outside here on Troost and you ask him, what are the vowels of American English? I don't think most people would be able to tell you. They'd go through the letters and they'd say, let's say there's A and there's E and there's O and there's U and maybe I. But they would actually not be able to tell you without very consistently thinking it through.
So are you talking about then the sound vowel sounds as opposed to the number of letters that
Yes.
we consider vowels?
Yes. So this is another part of the project that is not only did we have to figure out what the consonant vowels are, and this is mainly important for the vowels, but then step two is to render these in a Latin-based script that keeps the relation between how things are written and how they are spelled quite transparent. English is notoriously bad at this, right? So if I say a man was late, I use the letter A, right? But in the first case, it's a. In man, it's a. In was, it's a. And in late, it's a. So we have no one-to-one correspondence between a letter, A, and how it's pronounced.
Could you take us through the vowel sounds that English has? You mentioned that if you walked outside this studio and asked a typical person walking down the street, what are the vowel sounds of the English language that they might struggle? But so that people are following this process when we
Right.
speak about another language, what are the vowel sounds of English?
So the vowel sounds of English are E, I, E, E, A, O, E, U, E, R, and A.
That second to last one sounded like a consonant to me.
Has a little bit, has R quality to it, but it's typically considered a vowel. And then there's these things that are called diphthongs that kind of change their quality throughout the pronunciation. So you have things like I and ow.
Whoa,
and
okay.
Oy.
So how do you, could you walk us through the process of how you do the work itself? You mentioned that there are two steps, and as someone, especially someone who doesn't speak the language, your project is to transform the Kazakh language as it's written in Cyrillic script into the same Kazakh language written into Latin script.
Right.
So how do you do that project? Take us through the process and the steps, if you can.
So, of course, in the case of Kazakh, we had a known history of some a description of the language. If you were to start on a language that nobody had described before, you'd hopefully meet with a native speaker of that language, and you start with what linguists call a minimal pair test. So you latch onto some word in the language, and then you systematically start changing one of the sounds in that word until your speaker says, no, 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 that doesn't mean the same word anymore. Now we're onto something different. So in other words, if I would start in English with the word pick, and I would change it to something like kick, then that native English speaker would tell me, okay, now you're onto something different. That is a different word. And from that, I would conclude that p and k are independent sounds and each has to be represented by a different symbol.
Is there a letter you could change in that word where that wouldn't be the case, where you'd change a sound in the word pick and it would still be the same word?
I could say pick and I could say pick. And to you, you might hear a slight difference, but it's not a difference that's going to change your meaning.
So that's a p and a p.
Exactly. But there are languages, like Thai, for example, where these two would be different words.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So why is this an important project? What's going on in Kazakh politics and culture right now that that contextualizes this language transformation?
I think Kazakhstan, because of its Western-looking president, is a little bit ahead of some of its other Central Asia peers like Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and so on. And so the president is Western-looking. They have huge oil and gas reserves, and they want to make this connection to the Western world. So I think that's why where this push is coming from. Now, I was told that the president tried to do this a little earlier. He was from the get-go. He was convinced that this was an important step. But then he slowed down efforts because he felt that the time wasn't wasn't quite right for it. And so now he's stepped up these efforts again, but he's cautious. He realizes that you can't change the writing system overnight. So I think he has set 2020 or even 2025 as the ultimate year in which this transition will have been completed.
That also sounds very fast to me. I mean, if you think about the people in school right now who are in who are 11 years old will be what closer, I mean, they won't even be 21 yet when that transformation is complete, and they've got to relearn a writing system in that time. And that's not even to mention the adults who have already completed their educations and have the old dogs learning new tricks problem.
That's true. So I think to some extent they have to be convinced of the fact that it ultimately, economically speaking, will be an improvement for them. When I talk to the younger generations and I explain a little bit about what we're doing, they all say, thank goodness that will make texting so much easier. That's really, you know, on their pads, on their cell phones, they'll make things a little bit easier.
Because their cell phones are not made with Cyrillic in mind.
No, exactly. Now you can, of course, download all kinds of intermediate codes, but just having the buttons, you know, that we have on our cell phones and using them to send text in Kazakh would be a big step forward for them.
So it sounds like the push for this change is not just coming from President Nursultan Nazarbayev himself, but also from at least some portion of the population.
Yes, I think that's true. The group that I'm working with has kind of a blog where people can, you know, say what they like or don't like about the idea or the particular proposals that have been made. And in general, people are quite positive.
Have you had any interaction with the president?
I have not. I have met, so I taught a summer course. I just came back from Kazakhstan. So in addition to being a consultant on this project, I was asked to teach a summer course there so that I could also meet some of these collaborators face to face. And I met the president of the university, the provost, people like that, but not the president. Who knows? Maybe one of these times.
Yeah. What was it like for you to visit Kazakhstan? Did you know much about it outside of your language involvement?
I did not know much about it. I had traveled once to the former Soviet Union, but I had never gotten that far south, and this was in the mid-1970s. So I wasn't exactly sure what to expect. I'd seen some pictures on the web that showed a very modern city, which surprised me. And so there's two parts to the city, Astana, which is the capital. There's an old kind of Soviet-style city with the old apartment blocks with the little courtyard where people go out walking after meals and that I'm used to from Soviet days. And then you cross the river to the western part, and then there's Astana's modern business card, so to speak, where prominent international architects have been invited to really put the city and the country on the map. So it's very modern. There's skyscrapers. There's amazing architecture.
What's the food like?
I like the food quite a bit. It's typical Central Asian food. The number one delicacy in Kazakhstan is horse meat. So if you like horse meat, you're in good shape, which I do. As a kid, we used to eat horse meat in the Netherlands. Then there's, of course, the vodka. Then there's lots of potatoes and other stuff. The only thing that I could not get used to is what they call kumis, which is mare's milk, so fermented horse's milk. It's got a light alcohol percentage of about 4 to 5%. I could not acquire that taste.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Alard Youngman, a professor at KU. He's the chair of the linguistics department, and he's involved in literally transforming the Kazakh language. He's working with professors in Kazakhstan on that project. And what do you think of the project? Do you think that using Latin script will help Kazakhstan achieve its practical goals, its economic goals, or do you as a linguist focus on the linguistic project and refrain from making those judgments?
I typically refrain from making those judgments. It's not often that that I find myself in this situation. I'm what they call a phonetician, so I work on the acoustics of speech, the perception, the articulation of speech. So I'm very familiar with the first part. Let's try to figure out what the vowels and consonants are, what are their acoustic characteristics, what are the articulators that produce those sounds. What you do with that knowledge, of course, is less familiar to me, although I have to say the opportunity to shape the writing system is very exciting. It's rare that people realize that there ought to be a relation between the way a language is spelled and the way it sounds. English is, of course, a terrible example. I mentioned that earlier. So that's kind of exciting that at least somebody there realizes, hey, we actually have an opportunity to make that relation a little bit more transparent.
That interests me because I was wondering if the spoken language, if that's something you anticipate changing as a result of this change to the written language, or if the spoken language is unaffected by changes in how you write it.
I do think that it will change because we've seen the opposite happening with the change to the Cyrillic script. A while back we talked about part one of the project. And
recap that in case someone's just tuned in.
Yeah. So what I meant was you said, what's the difficulty? How hard can it be in a way to figure out what the consonant vowels of the language are? And I mentioned all the borrowings that have come in from the language from Russian. And so people thinking that some of the sounds that are in those borrowings are really Kazakh sounds, and it turns out they're not. But the other complicating factor, getting back to your question about the writing system, is that once the Cyrillic alphabet was adopted, this was in the early 1940s, every Kazakh sound had to be represented by a Cyrillic symbol. Well, if there was a one-to-one mapping, so let's say, you know, Russian has the sound M, okay, and Kazakh does too, so now we can use the Cyrillic symbol for M, and we're all set. But what if Kazakh has this particular sound that Russian doesn't have? Which symbol are we going to use to represent that Kazakh sound? Well, probably the one that comes closest to it in Russian. So it's close to it, but it's not quite the same. If you do that for 70-some years, you get a little bit of drift in the system where people now start pronouncing that sound the way the closest Russian sound is pronounced, moving away from the original Kazakh pronunciation. So in that sense, yes, there is a clear influence of the writing system on the spoken language, such that now when we move it back, or we change it, I should say, to Latin-based script, and we get that relation straightened out, that will probably slightly change the pronunciation of some of the sounds, particularly the vowel sounds.
Is it common for changes in language to be deliberate like this, for someone to be brought in to adapt the way people write? For example, I've always thought of change in language as something that's organic, happens over time.
That's true. So that's sound change or language change within a language, or due to contact between languages. But sometimes these decisions are, of course, often more politically or economically based, and they happen quite regularly. So Turkish, a major language that used to be written in an Arabic script, made the change in the 1920s, and there's other languages too. Of course, Kazakhstan is not alone in this. Some of these neighboring republics are also thinking about it or doing it. Kyrgyzstan has been talking about it, but they haven't done anything yet. Uzbekistan has actually made a change. Turkmenistan is also, again, thinking about it. So the people I'm working with in Kazakhstan are hopeful that this model will maybe encourage these other countries to really take that final step as well.
That politics affect language might be a little bit intuitive, but that economic goals and technological advancements like keypads on cell phones might also drive language changes is a little more surprising, though maybe it shouldn't be. I mean, texting is a huge part of life,
right?
Modern life.
Yep.
Globally.
Yeah.
But are there other examples of that historically where a technological change or an economic impulse is just directly linked to a change in language like that?
I would not know. Of course, sometimes it's directly changed to people abandoning a language entirely, right? So when you look at the number of minority language and endangered languages both in the U.S. and across the world, oftentimes the reason people abandon that language, typically in favor of English nowadays, is that they stand to gain economically. Say, why would I keep on speaking my native language if I can't find a job or it makes my life harder? And if I learn English, I have more economic prospects. That's often a reason. And that way, if you do that for a couple of generations, you will lose the entire language.
That does bring me to something else I've been wondering, which is that when a language changes, does it ever change back?
After it has changed, does it ever change back?
Yeah.
I don't know of any such cases, although, of course, in this particular case, we are trying to ultimately line up Kazakh with the way it was spoken before all the Russian domination and influences. But it's, as you say, it's very much typically an organic process. So things will change slowly over time due to a variety of factors, and there'll be a sort of a logical progression rather than a reversion to something that happened earlier.
You mentioned earlier that most people in Kazakhstan are bilingual in Russian and Kazakh.
Yeah.
But you've also mentioned that those two have blended somewhat. Do you think that, you know, do you think that people really will begin to re-separate them?
That's difficult to say. And so the question is ultimately, will people still feel that they need Russian, you know, for their own prosperity or other reasons, or do they feel that ultimately with these changes over time, and I'm talking, of course, about decades, that they may be able to wean themselves from Russian at all. Right now, you're right, they're taught both Russian and Kazakh in the schools. The president has just added English to that, so there's going to be trilingual language education now, which is quite unique and progressive, and I don't know what will happen to that in the future.
It seems sort of like, if the purpose for this is economic prosperity and a really global economy, that more people speak Russian than Kazakh, could it work against Kazakh as a language to re-separate these two?
It depends to what extent the people of Kazakhstan view Kazakh as their way to hold on and express their national identity. And I think there will be quite a big push for that, because that's, of course, what makes them unique and unifies them as a country. It's not Russian, because of a variety of historical precedents and so on. It's the Kazakh language and the culture that binds them. So I think they will hold on to that.
Professor Youngman, you've written a textbook called Phonetics, Transcription, Production, Acoustics, and Perception. A lot of our listeners might remember Hooked on Phonics, but that might be the last time they thought really directly about phonetics. What is phonetics? That seems to be your expertise.
Right. So phonetics, most broadly defined, is the scientific study of speech sounds. And the way I work on it, it can be the articulation of speech sounds. So what are the organs in the human body, in the mouth, of course, primarily, and so on, the lips, the tongue, and so on, that help produce different speech sounds? How is an E different from an OO, from a P, from a S?
How do we make the E sound? What are the muscles working there? What did I just do physiologically when I said E?
Okay, so first of all, you may not be aware of this, but down in your voice box, your larynx, the vocal folds are vibrating, okay? And that sets up a particular signal that travels through the rest of your vocal tracts, your throat, your mouth, and so on. And then by modifying that basic source signal that's being generated by your vocal folds, you make different vowels. So for E, you actually put your tongue up fairly high, close to the roof of your mouth, and the highest point of your tongue is relatively forward rather than back.
But not all the way on the roof of my mouth.
Not all the way, because then you would be blocking the airflow entirely.
That's so weird to make a sound and think about how you're doing it. We usually don't think about that at all.
Right.
Well, what about some of these other words, particularly acoustics and perception?
So the acoustics has not been a field for that long in phonetics, because it requires particular equipment to visualize the speech signal. So it's really since the end of World War II that we have equipment to visualize the speech signal. And so the idea is that as you change your tongue and your jaw, as you go from E to A and U, you emphasize different components of that source signal that's generated by the vocal folds, and you get different resonances to show up. And so you can measure the frequency of these resonances. And in fact, when you give me a piece of paper and you say, I have a vowel here, and the first resonance has a frequency of so many hertz, and the second resonance has a frequency of that many hertz, I can tell you, oh, that's probably oo, or that's ah, or that's e. And we think that's how listeners do it too. They extract these resonances from the sound they hear, map it onto a stored representation in their brain, and say, okay, that must be that particular vowel.
What is it about linguistics that really captivated you and made you want to dedicate your life to its research?
I went to high school in the Netherlands, I was good at learning languages. I picked up languages pretty quickly, and there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, Holland is such a small country that if you travel for more than 2 hours in any direction, you're in a foreign-speaking country. So it's also, there's a practical need for knowing more than one language. So I picked up languages pretty easily. But I decided I didn't want to be a language teacher. I didn't want to be in a high school class, certainly not with a kid like me, and it was not appealing.
Right. Well, that's sort of the obvious course to take if you're a language person.
Yeah. And so I talked to a high school counselor. I don't know how it is now, but in those days we all always made a lot of fun of high school counselors. But she actually said, have you ever thought about linguistics? And I did not know what it was, and I picked up a brief book, and it looked very interesting. And then I wrote to the university, and they said, yes, we have linguistics, but you have to first get your BA in a language or in philosophy or in psychology. It's a post-BA training.
So what did you do?
So then I majored in Russian. And I picked Russian because I said, well, if I'm going to do linguistics, then it would be good to have access to another language family. You know, in high school we get French, so you have the Romance languages and Latin. We get German and English, so you have, and Dutch, of course, you have the Germanic languages covered. So I wanted to pick a different language family. That's how I picked Russian at the time.
What brought you to Kansas after doing all of this?
I came to graduate school to get my PhD in the United States. So that's when I left the Netherlands and traveled around within the U.S., various places, went back to Holland again, and then eventually ended up here because they had a nice opportunity for me and my wife, who's also a linguist. You know, it's hard enough to find one job, let alone two, in a field which is as small as ours. And so that was perfect for us.
Two linguists in one house. Do you, is there a lot of analyzing what has just been said and parsing of words, so to speak?
No, I think otherwise we wouldn't talk. Neither of us would talk at all. So no, we don't. We leave that at work.
That's good. Is it hard for you to talk to regular people like me about your work? You've spent years specializing and taking your mastery beyond the ordinary realm. How do you answer my questions in mere seconds? I mean, for someone with no background to be able to understand you.
Well, first of all, you ask very good questions, so that makes it a lot easier. But
go on.
The great thing about working in linguistics is that you work on something that everybody knows something about and has opinion. Right? Everybody speaks a language, or oftentimes more than one language, and everybody has an opinion. That's an advantage and a disadvantage. The advantage is that you easily draw people in because, you know, we all know what we're talking about. The disadvantage is sometimes that people don't think about language as sort of an objective structure that can be analyzed. They all have very emotional connotations, which can sometimes be hard to get past. But in general, you know, I'd much rather, I think, you know, talk about linguistics and language to someone than something very esoteric that they don't even think about or work with on a daily basis.
Is it important for regular people to know about what you're doing, or does it matter mostly to you and the people of Kazakhstan?
In this particular Kazakh project, I think it's nice for people to realize that there is this writing system and there is a spoken language, and the relation between the two should not be arbitrary. Okay, oftentimes it is, but it should not. And I think, in my opinion, it would probably help people's learning of a language. If the writing system of a language were such that it directly embodied the way in which particular speech sounds were produced, I think you could start teaching that writing system at a much earlier age. I think people would have less trouble learning it. So there are lessons there, I think.
So people understanding what it is you do and how you do it would help them learn languages better?
Yes.
Do you think it's important for people to know multiple languages?
I do. I think it's the norm nowadays. Sometimes we forget that in the U.S., which is still to some extent a monolingual country, although that's very rapidly changing. If you look across the countries in the world, they tend to be multilingual, bilingual, trilingual, and so on. There are studies that show that this also gives you general cognitive advantages. So knowing two languages, knowing three languages, not only advantageous for whatever work reasons or other reasons, but also at later ages, we've been shown to be more flexible when we know more than one language. It has memory advantages, cognitive advantages. It might slow down onset of Alzheimer's, dementia, and so on. There's many reasons why being more than monolingual is advantageous.
It's a compelling prescription for learning languages.
That's right.
Do the Kazakh faculty you've been working with abroad kind of balk on some level at a Dutchman from Kansas telling them how to adapt their language?
I sure hope not. And if they do, they certainly did not voice that opinion. I think in general the fact that I spoke a little Russian helped. So I wasn't like a complete outside American or Dutchman who came in. But I think the main reason is, of course, to shore up this notion of what are the consonants and vowels of the language. And then also I have direct contact with, you know, peer-reviewed journals and so on. I mean, that's kind of what we do in academics in the U.S. and many other countries, whereas the academics there typically tend to publish in their in-house publications in Russian or in Kazakh that are not peer-reviewed, that are not seen by the rest of the world. So I think part of the reason to contact me was also to make sure that we write up this analysis of the language and publish it in a journal that has a lot of international credibility, and that can then serve as a benchmark to, you know, point and say, like, okay, this is where we establish what the consonants and vowels are.
Do you personally ever marvel at your role in this really, really significant change to a language that, I mean, the language that a person speaks is so near and dear to his or her heart, you know, and it's that you are involved in a transformation of a language in a country on the other side of the globe?
Yeah, I do. It's of course, an amazing opportunity. It's a much greater responsibility that somebody who does, you know, phonetic research typically has. It also means they really screw things up. So I marvel at it, but I wait until, you know, we're done with the project, and I hope that the outcome will be a good one.
Does it make you nervous?
Not at this stage.
What about your collaborators in Kazakhstan? Have you made friends with some of them? Do you think you'll be like pen pals?
I think so, or at least Skype pals. So the graduate student I have been working with, and we Skype on a regular basis, and his English is very good. The professor, we communicate. It was actually interesting because his French is about as good or as about as poor as my Russian. So between the variety of he doesn't speak any English. So between the variety of languages, we kind of were able to work things out.
Is it sort of like going back to the Tower of Babel a little bit?
It is, but with vodka, and that really helps.
If only they'd had that.
That's right.
Well, you know, that's all the time we have for this conversation with Allard Youngman, chair of the linguistics department at the University of Kansas. He's a Kansan by way of the Netherlands, and he's working with the people of Kazakhstan to adapt the Kazakh language. Professor Youngman, thanks so much for being here today. It's been so much fun.
Thanks for having me. Rahmet, as we say in Kazakh.
I'll have to learn how to say that later. Thanks again.